Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is esteemed journalist and former presidential advisor and Lincoln biographer, Sidney Blumenthal. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to our sponsors, Earth Breeze and Stellar Sleep, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Now, please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Hey, James, we're going to be joined today by someone who is going to elevate us, bring much more distinction. Sidney Blumenthal, a great writer, a great political thinker, and the author of a wonderful, wonderful five-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. Sidney, thanks for being with us. And we want to, you know, you so elevate us. We just want to make you part of the conversation, and maybe we'll get smarter before the day's over.
Well, I'm going to get smarter, too. Thanks for being
here.
You know,
let me just start. There was a Politico piece this week about the president's brother, Jim, trading on the family name, hustling businesses, some of which was a scam. And whatever Hunter's son, Hunter's legal issue is, he's done the same. That's happened with other presidents, of course, too. But nothing has led to Biden. And Hunter, for all of his faults, never, to my knowledge, got a multi-billion dollar sweetheart deal from the Saudis for appreciation of what he did for them, like Jared Kushner. But let me tell you the worst thing I think this week, and I think this really goes really to the core of what the Republicans are trying to do. It was revealed that Alexander Smirnoff, who was the centerpiece of the Republican charges against President Biden for the, I think, ludicrous charge taking bribes, he was indicted. Smirnoff was indicted. Not only is he a liar, but prosecutors raised the possibility he was a Russian agent. Now, we've heard very little from those who peddled the Smirnoff story repeatedly. Congressman James Comer, who, as James Carville has pointed out, probably has an IQ that doesn't quite reach room temperature, or 90-year-old Chuck Grassley, who may be senile, or from Sean Hannity, the Fox hitman, who I think cited him, one account today said 85 times. These were, in the old vernacular, useful idiots. You know, I have to think, though, Sidney and James, somehow, when you put this all together, the Russians and false propaganda and peddling stuff to the Sean Hannitys and the Comers and the Grassley of the world, I think that the hand of Donald Trump has to be in here somewhere. Sid?
Well, this is, as far as I can see it, part two of what was the first impeachment of Donald Trump for going to Ukraine, threatening President Zelensky, threatening to withhold Javelin missiles from him to defend himself against Putin in exchange for fabricated dirt on Biden that was being dug up by Rudy Giuliani, who was certainly in touch with Trump. And here we have part two. And it seems to be part of the same pattern of a Russian disinformation campaign trying to interfere in the presidential election. And some of the same characters may well be involved. I'd be very interested to know about Smirnoff's background and whether he's an asset or actually an intelligence agent himself. We haven't quite determined all that. There's a lot more to know, and we never got to the bottom of the first impeachment of everyone involved. So what we're looking at here, big picture, is a Russian operation, an op, to affect the presidential election in favor of Donald Trump. And I think that's indisputable. And beneath that, there's a lot of investigation that needs to be done, and it's not going to be done by James.
And James, as Sidney said, this is chapter two. It's they tried to beat him the first time, by cheating and illicit means and using the Russians. And now they're back at it again for the second time. I know Mr. Carville is outraged by this, and I'm waiting for him to vent his outrage. No.
It's so hard to when you digest the reality of it, right? It's like anything normal in politics. They start this, there's zero evidence. Of course, the entire story about the prosecutor that Biden went there to get rid of, everybody in the Western world wanted
every
this
good guy
out
every,
of there.
Every good, yeah. Was,
every, yeah. Every good guy. I mean, people don't care. They're told constantly that this guy was investigating Burisma and Biden went over there and got him fired. It's 100% the opposite of true. And, you know, remember, I guess it was Kellyanne Conway talked about alternative facts. And that's just where we are. Just from a historical basis, have we ever been in this place before where a huge part of the electorate just demands to be lied to and doesn't really give a shit about facts?
Well, Lincoln talked about the debauchery of public opinion, for sure. He was certainly going on in his time leading into the Civil War and during it. But this is the third presidential election in a row where the Russians have indisputably interfered. And we now know that it's going on right now. We've had two before, and now we're just at the beginning of the revelations of the third one in 2024. We had 2016, 2020, 2024. Putin has strategic aims to try and create chaos in the United States, to elect Donald Trump as his handmaiden, to let him do what he wants, and to attack and try and take over Ukraine and possibly other countries in Europe. So this is a pattern that we ought to recognize, and public opinion, which my friend Abraham Lincoln referred to as debauched, ought to recognize it. Our Republican friends, very different from the Republican Party of Lincoln's day, to say the least, are really engaged now in a cover-up. That's what's going on. That's the real crime going on.
Well, I would encourage every organization that has investigative reporters, you cannot spend too much time on Mr. Smirnoff. There's something there. My guess is those tentacles go not just to the Kremlin, but here in this country too. Because every day, James and Sydney, this is just more and more, lends more credence to what Liz Cheney has called the Putin wing of the Republican Party. Trump says if NATO countries don't spend sufficiently on defense, he'd invite Putin to invade them. The reaction from most Republicans, Rubio and Graham and others, was, well, silence, or, you know, yeah, they ought to spend more. And the former Trump aides say, if he's elected, Trump really wants to terminate NATO. What would be the implications of that, Sid?
Well, as John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor, said, he definitely wants to do that. He's heard him say it, and that he doesn't have to actually leave NATO. He can just not act within it and allow Putin to do what he wants. So the danger of that, of course, is that it opens Europe to Russian attacks of all kinds, including cyber warfare against their economy. It completely destabilizes the entire European Union, as well as our NATO allies. And that would destabilize our entire economy and society as well. So the results will be drastic. There's no question about it.
Let me ask the both of you something, because both of you, you know, very serious journalists over the years, and involved in many investigative journalism pieces and stuff like this. The reason that journalists like to do this is because they think, and it was true in the past, that something like this would really affect public opinion, that they'd have something good. If I'm a top-tier investigative journalist, I get an assignment, and so I'm going to work 4 or 5 months on this story, 10 hours a day, and I'm going to print it, and it's not going to move anybody. So but why go to the trouble? I mean, if they found out that there was a, which I think there is, some version of a P-tape, some compromise, some, there are probably 10 things that Putin has on Trump, I don't know if it would matter.
Well, you know, that's the least of it. The mythical P-tape about Trump's compromise in Moscow. Look at the chronology that's just happened recently. You know, one thing I've learned in writing history is that chronology is your friend. You learn a lot just by following how events happen and follow each other. There's cause and effect. So just look at this. Trump says he encourages Russia to attack European nations who are NATO allies, and he would do nothing. This is then followed by the Tucker Carlson interview with Putin, where Putin arrogantly struts, talking about how Russian history has directed him to seize Ukraine. And then he starts talking about how Poland isn't really a nation. And then he justifies the Hitler-Stalin pact that led to World War II. And then he says, Poland provoked the Nazis. And then Navalny is murdered. And in the meantime, Trump has definitely told Mike Johnson, who says he talks to Trump all the time on the phone, and then went on a pilgrimage to pay homage to Trump at Mar-a-Lago, to block the bill of aid to Ukraine. So these events are not happenstance. They're happening in history in real time right now.
So I'll jump in this too. So why is it that it doesn't matter? How did these people come to like totalitarianism or poison a guy to death or saying a country like Poland that's got distinct culture, history, everything that you could possibly imagine that would make something a country? Why do they not care?
James, I'd love to hear Sid on this because he is really an eminent historian now. I think there always was an element there. And, you know, we saw it with Joe McCarthy. We saw it with others. And I think Trump is a completely evil person. There's no good qualities to Donald Trump. There were good qualities to Richard Nixon. In reading about Joe McCarthy, even Joe McCarthy had some good qualities that were far outweighed by the bad ones. Trump has no good qualities. But you know something? He is really a very effective propagandist. And he is able to tap into those grievances, that bigotry, as well as anybody. And I think it was at a level, what you're talking about, if it was on a scale 1 to 10, if it was a 5, Trump is taking it up to a 9. And I don't know how you wind it back down. But Sid, you'll know more about this than I do.
Well, why Trump's followers are in a cult of personality is one of the great questions of our time. And they've now elevated him into a Christ-like figure so that he can claim to be a martyr. And they worship him. He's an idol. He's a god to them. And they've even given up their own religion to worship him. He's above it. They used to say, well, he's a broken vessel who's doing great things like packing the courts with Federalist Society judges. But now they're beyond that. He's godlike, and the 91 felonies that he faces in 4 trials, they see as his persecution by the Pharisees. And so we're the evil ones, the press, the media, the globalists. There's a whole worldview that he has created around himself for his MAGA base. There's still a Republican base, but it's now a minority. You can see it through the Nikki Haley vote. But that's the old conservatism, the old Republican Party. And they have their own policies, their own point of view, but it's not a cult. You can disagree, right. You can agree or disagree with them.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the reaction to the brutal murder of the courageous dissident Alexei Navalny, clearly ordered by Putin, was so instructive and goes to Liz Cheney's point. Trump predictably said, well, it's just like what they're doing to me. Oh, really? And then, let's not just think it's Trump. The Amen chorus weighed in. Newt Gingrich said, and I'm quoting now, watch the Biden administration speak out against Putin and his jailing of leading political opponents while Democrats in four different jurisdictions try to turn President Trump into an American Navalny. James, I don't really think you see any similarities between Alexei Navalny and Donald Trump, but that's what the Newt Gingriches and Donald Trumps of the world are peddling, and they're getting away with it.
Yeah, you think that the people, that woman that the Russians arrested for gave $51 to Ukraine, but what's her, you think she's going to get a trial, a hearing, a motion day, a jury, an appellate court, anything like that? Get out of here. I mean, it's all so goddamn stupid, phony. And again, I'll go back to the depression thing is there are millions of people that believe that shit. There was some poll that said 20% believe that Taylor Swift rigged the Super Bowl. Well, that's 65, 70 million people. When you get on an airplane, it's a good chance you're sitting next to somebody that thinks Taylor Swift rigged the Super Bowl. It's a much better chance you're sitting next to somebody that thinks that Putin is good and Trump won the 2020 election.
And the January 6th was a peaceful protest.
Crazy-ass people. Yeah, peaceful protest, yeah, but a tourist stop. And not much moves them. Cindy, you got any ideas? Are these people movable, or we just have to wait for the actuarial tables?
I don't think they're movable, and I don't think they want to hear who Vladimir Putin is and what he does and what his methods are and what his goals are. And they can't comprehend it, just as I think they don't actually know who Donald Trump really is. They haven't gotten to the bottom of what Al calls his evil. They see him as, you know, a successful businessman. Well, we know what that's about after the trial in New York. I just want to say about Putin. About 20 years ago, I met a journalist named Anna Politkovskaya, who was a Russian journalist, and she worked for a Russian publication. I met her in Sweden at a conference on the media, and she had been reporting on what Putin was up to. And she told me that she had been in an airplane, and she'd been poisoned and almost died. We now know what that sort of thing is all about. And I had a long talk with her about what life was like under Putin and the repressive measures that he was attempting to implement. I said, be careful. She went back. On Putin's birthday, she was assassinated by gunmen in the elevator of her apartment building. It was a birthday present. So that's what we're dealing with when we're dealing with this dictator. And Trump, in his own way, you know, looks up to this daddy figure, Putin, who he defers to. Even you can see it in his body language when he was with him, and wants to be a dictator for a day. So, you know, we can only hope that Americans will recognize that there's an American majority as opposed to a pro-Putin party that's now blocking aid to Ukraine and trying to destroy the Western alliance in the interests of Vladimir Putin. And it turns out...
Yeah, Liz Cheney talked about the Putin wing of the Republican Party, Sydney. It is the It is the Putin Republican Party more than a wing, because it is the dominant wing now, I think, because that's what Trump is. James, I want to turn now to something that is going to be much more uplifting, and that is Sidney Blumenthal's really just majestical five-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. Sid, I've only read part of your Lincoln biography. That reflects my limitations, not the...
Well, you can't read 4 and 5.
The greatness of your, well, okay, I've read 2, so I'm two-thirds of the way there, whatever. You know, most of us revere Lincoln. He kept the Union together, the great emancipator, perhaps probably the most eloquent president. The Gettysburg Address is like 2 minutes and 272 words that live for the ages. But all that was because, as you've written, he was one terrific politician.
That's correct. We would have... Lincoln was not a... godlike figure. He was not living in the clouds. He was not apart from earth. He was somebody that you, Al, and you, James, would spend a long evening with talking about politics. That's who he was. And he knew everything going on. People described him as a cute politician. The word cute in the 19th century meant really cunning. And he was gregarious when he wanted to be, a joke teller, but he was also very silent when he needed to be. And he faced the greatest crisis in our history. And the way he got through it was by being a political genius. And the political part is not to be denigrated, because that's the part that saved democracy, and that actually is the essence of democracy. And people need to recognize it and not denigrate, you know, people involved in politics, working for goals, and people who, you know, have to compromise to get there. You know, Lincoln said, "I may be slow, but I never step back." So, you know, thinking about politicians today who are criticized because they're slower, they don't accomplish everything all at once, or the kinds of difficulties they have to face. Lincoln said, you know, "I've been controlled by circumstances. I haven't controlled circumstances." So, you know, we need to appreciate and learn how this all works in order to understand our own
democracy. And that, I mean, Sidney, that extraordinary comeback he made from the dark years after he left Congress before he was president, certainly before 1858, was really remarkable.
Yeah, well, the short course, he's Lincoln in the wilderness. Lincoln serves one term in the Congress. He's an obscure backbencher Whig from downstate Illinois, central Illinois, and... he'd made a deal where he'd only have one term. So he gives it up. He comes home. He tried to get a big patronage job, head of the land office, very important job, controlling a hell of a lot of patronage and, you know, giving out the land in the United States. And he didn't get it. He didn't have the clout then. Comes home, and he's this country lawyer, you know, wandering around central Illinois on a horse, going county to county, arguing in these courthouses. And then something happens, a great event. It's, you know, the great events happen that change politics. We're living through those right now. The Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court is an event that's transformed a lot. We'll see if this Putin business transforms things, but certainly the Dobbs decision does. Well, there was a big decision that was made then. It was the Kansas-Nebraska Act that was sponsored by Lincoln's great rival, Stephen A. Douglas, the other senator. Lincoln said, "He's a colossus. I walk under his legs." was the little giant. He was 5 feet tall. Lincoln was 6'4". But everyone thought Douglas would be president. He wanted to be president, so he passed this bill. He thought he needed to get the Kansas-Nebraska territory, all this vast territory, organized so he could build a transcontinental railroad, and he could take credit, and that would make him president. And the result of it was they opened the territory to slavery, and the whole country just split apart. And Lincoln says, you know, we rose from, you know, from the back, you know, wielding axes. So Lincoln is now back in the fray again. Runs, compressing the story, he runs for governor, rather for a Senator Lincoln in 1855. Doesn't sound like an election year, but it was. Now, people were not elected by the popular vote. They're elected by the legislature. And Lincoln has the most votes, but there are several other candidates. And there's one candidate who's backed by Douglas and the governor, who's a corrupt guy, and Lincoln doesn't want him to win, and he's rising up. So Lincoln throws his votes, even though he's ahead, to the other candidate who's a Democrat. Remember, Lincoln's still he's given up being a Whig, but he's not really a Republican. And he's moving, and he throws it to Lyman Trumbull, and who's he's anti-slavery. So he throws the votes to him, and Trumbull becomes senator. Lincoln's wife never speaks to Trumbull's wife again, by the way. So Lincoln has made the basis of the coalition of the new Republican Party by doing that favor. By sacrificing his own ambition, he's brought in these anti-slavery Democrats, and they create the new Republican Party. Runs for senator against Douglas in 1858. Big debate about the extension of slavery in the territories. They go town to town. They argue back and forth. It's the great entertainment in Illinois. You know, there's no TV. There's no radio. They're no great, you know. They don't have rock concerts. They go to these debates and these political speeches. Thousands, tens of thousands of people. You know, they come day ahead. It's a big festival, and not needless to say, a lot of drinking. And they listen to these speeches, and Lincoln makes a name for himself, and he speaks against slavery. He's the great voice from the West. As it was, Illinois was in the West. And Lincoln is reported in the New York newspapers. These debates are reported. The newspapers are very different then. They used to be filled with the debates in the Congress and real debates and just pages and pages of the actual debates because you couldn't see TV, couldn't hear it on the radio. You had newspapers. And so Lincoln suddenly makes a name for himself, but no one really knows who he is, even though he spent his whole life in politics, running since the age of 22 for office. And he loses the Senate race to Douglas, even though he wins the popular vote, because it's controlled by the legislature. And the legislature decides that by a majority to give it to Douglas, because the Democrats win the seats, because I know this is a shock to a contemporary audience, but it's gerrymandered.
Of course
that wouldn't
not.
Happen today.
Of course not.
So Lincoln loses the race by winning the popular vote. And on his way home after losing, he slips. He falls in the mud. He says it's a slip, not a fall. He's very depressed, given to melancholy, they call it. And he decides, we'll see what happens. He's invited to Ohio. There's an election in Ohio for governor in the state legislature. He speaks, he goes all around the state. Turns out he's a very vibrant, healthy guy. He's a great public speaker. Douglas goes to Ohio. He's worn out. The debates have basically destroyed him physically. Douglas is not old, but he is an alcoholic, and he's drinking himself to death. And Lincoln, the Republicans win. They sweep the state in Ohio, 1859. Lincoln's helped a lot. Lincoln comes home. He says to his inner circle, you know what? People say William Seward, the great senator from New York, is going to be our nominee. But why not me? What do you think? How about that? They go, I don't know. We don't know. What Lincoln says, I think this is I think we can do it. It turns out these so-called rustics from Illinois were the roughest, toughest, canniest, smartest politicos in the country. They go, and I'll end the story here on this one little anecdote. They send one of their members to the Republican National Committee meeting to determine where the convention is. And all the favorite sons want it in their city. And the delegate from Illinois says, well, we don't have a candidate. So how about Chicago? And they say, oh, all right, we'll put it in Chicago.
That was the James Carville of his day.
Convention hall. There were a lot of them then around Lincoln. These were really smart political people. And so the guy who runs it, the James Carville of the convention, is Judge David Davis, weighs 300 pounds. You know, there are two James Carvilles in.
That's a scary thought. Two James Carvilles. Wow.
Yeah. And he goes to the Tremont Hotel in Chicago, and he nails up over the door that says, Illinois delegation. And they start running favors and they're up, you know, I'd say 72 hours without sleep. And in and out, people from Indiana and Ohio and Pennsylvania running around, and they're making deals with the delegations. And Lincoln sends a telegram to David Davis. David had been the maestro of the court circuit where Lincoln had practiced in central Illinois. He was the judge. They would all travel around together. Davis is a great figure. Lincoln would later appoint him to the Supreme Court. And Lincoln sends a telegram. He's staying in Springfield. And he says, you know, make no deals on my account. And Davis gets the telegram, and he turns to the other guys in the room, and he says, Lincoln ain't here. And, you know, strangely enough, you know, there was someone from Indiana and someone from Pennsylvania and someone from Ohio in the cabinet.
And Seward.
So... And Seward, that's another story. Thurlow Weed, the great political boss of New York for Seward, came with a trainload of 1,000 people, including the former heavyweight champion of the world, and a lot of drink and literally piles of cash to hand out. And when Seward lost the election, he burst into tears on the convention floor. So, he recovered his composure and went to Springfield, and he was willing to deal. And soon Seward was Secretary
of
State.
Pretty good deal, James Carville.
So, Cindy, you've been through what I call the stations of the cross of high-end journalism in the United States. I think you started with the Boston Phoenix. You were at the New Republic, which people remember used to be a really big deal. You were at the New Yorker. You were at the Today Show. You were at the Washington Post. And you were a senior White House aide. And then you decide, now understand that I know this, there have been more books written on Abraham Lincoln than any other single American, and I don't even think it's that close. So you decide that you're going to harrow this plowed ground that's been plowed 1,000 times by some of the most eminent people in the world, and you're going to – what gave you the confidence that mid-career you could accomplish something like this after being in journalism the whole time? You're not a graduate degree, you know, PhD in history. And you got people like Hal Holzer, who is the dean of current Lincoln scholars, and David Shribman, who worked for Al, is a terrific journalist and a very accomplished amateur historian himself. How did you come about this, and what gave you the gumption to just go ahead and do this?
Yeah, well, James, I don't think it was gumption or confidence. It was foolishness. It was a kind of madness. I started doing it. I had started doing a work on presidents and race since FDR and trying to figure out how the parties had changed identities as a result of race. And I kept going deeper and deeper into the past, and I got to Lincoln. And once I got to Lincoln, I got to the Civil War. And then I went deeper and I said, I don't get it. I need to understand the origins of Lincoln. And I got to his earliest part, and I was just scratching at it until I could try and make sense of the earliest Lincoln. And I started writing, and I didn't stop writing. I was encouraged by my friend, Sean Mullins, historian at Princeton. He said, keep going. And what I found over time, I figured out how to do this and how things worked. And what I learned is that American politics is American politics, and that my skills as a journalist were very applicable here in figuring out what went wrong and what went right and how and what happened. And that if I followed the footnotes, I could go to the original sources and I could find out what was there and see what the academics might have missed because they didn't quite get politics. And I had my own experience, not only as a journalist, but being in the White House and being involved in the presidency, knowing a president, so on, and knowing people like Mr. Carbo. So that was a very different sensibility to bring to the writing of history than a lot of academics. And so that's how I kept going. I just foolishly kept going and writing, and I am still engaged in this madness, deep in, in the weeds of this stuff. I just finished a chapter for my volume 4 on Lincoln and Kentucky, trying to figure this out. And it has a deep relationship to emancipation, because Lincoln would not move on emancipation until the whole geostrategic theater of war was secure in the West, and Kentucky was secure. He said, the abolitionists came to him and they made moral cases against slavery, and he said, I'd like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky. So it's that kind of understanding of people's motivation. The other thing is, we've lived in Washington and we've lived, in other cities, Boston, New Orleans, Pennsylvania, all places, Chicago. I grew up in Chicago. And we've learned that people in politics know other people, that it's about relationships. And you have to know what Lincoln understood, what his 360 world was, and Lincoln was a student of human nature. He had X-ray vision. He learned through a whole lifetime how to understand what people's motives were, and how to deal with them. And you have to know who the people are and who he knew. These are not all abstract material forces. Politics is about real people and people in politics and what they are trying to do with each other. And Lincoln was a great student of human beings, of people, as a basis for politics. And he was hardwired for this. His wit, his understanding, his sense of policy, his principles, all that were in this. He would fuse in the service of his politics. So that's an insight that has been incredibly helpful to me in being able to write this history.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of things that we hear about and just take us a little bit deeper. I can't imagine any politician giving a speech today like the second inaugural. I mean, talk to a little bit about, because everybody knows the Gettysburg Address, and as they well should. I mean, I know I almost not memorize it. But the second inaugural was a compilation of a lot of things in his life and views and, you know, the war and everything. Just talk to us about that speech.
Well, let me talk about that speech and other Lincoln speeches. Lincoln was always thinking. He was always trying to figure out the problem. And he was always trying to figure out how you talk to people and how you frame it and what the rhetoric should be. And he's constantly thinking about this. And he would distill this through speech after speech after speech. He was his own speechwriter. The other thing he was a lawyer. So Lincoln's a forensic lawyer. Lincoln wants to win the argument. That's the other thing to always remember about Lincoln. He wants to win his cases. And the public is his jury. And sometimes he's going to use homely stories. Sometimes he's going to do elevated rhetoric. But he wants to win the argument. And he always has an opponent. So, and he wants to know what their case is, and he wants to poke holes in it, and he wants to defeat it. So looking at Lincoln's speeches, including the second inaugural, you have to look at who's his opponent, who's on the other side, and what have they said? And the answer is, in this, for many years, it was Stephen A. Douglas. And those debates reflect that, the great debates in the Senate campaign of 1858. But then Douglas dies, Lincoln becomes president, Douglas dies, and he faces other adversaries. And he faces Jefferson Davis. And he studies the speeches of Davis. And Davis argues that the North is responsible and Lincoln's responsible for the war. And that the issue is states' rights, and the issue is the right to secession and state sovereignty, and that there's a constitutional basis for what the Confederacy did and a legitimacy to it. And Lincoln is taking that argument in the second inaugural, and he is destroying it piece by piece by piece. And remember, he says, and the war came. In that speech. And then he explains why the war came. And he puts it on slavery. And he explains why it was necessary to destroy slavery in order for democracy to survive in that great inaugural speech. And it is in great part an answer to the rhetoric of Jefferson Davis, which now has been forgotten. But Lincoln, the politician is, and the lawyer becomes the statesman because he wants to win, and he wants to win the argument.
Wow.
He's not doing it for effect. He's not doing it because of moral vanity. He doesn't want to be seen as having had the most beautiful flourishes of his rhetoric. He wants to win. That's Lincoln.
So we're going to turn it over to Al. I've got one more in talking about wanting to win. And this is not eloquent, but I think mine, and I know it's one of yours, favorite Lincoln quote is, let the thing be pressed. Could you give us the context of that quote?
Well, Ulysses Grant, general of the armies, has gone through the Wilderness Campaign. It is a terrible battle, fighting through the underbrush of the wilderness in Virginia. Great casualties, 1864.
Al's grandmother was
Orange, Virginia.
Right there in the wilderness. Yeah,
Right there. The hospitals of the North are filled with the casualties of the Union Army. And Grant is called a butcher. Even Mary Lincoln says to Lincoln, you know, he's a butcher. And Lincoln's popularity has fallen. He thinks he's going to lose the election. It's 1864. It's re-election time. And they keep going. And he says to Grant, let the thing be pressed. You know, he wants Grant to keep going. And this is when Grant's in the lines south of Richmond. Just keep, you know, go on the offensive. Don't stop. Lincoln, interestingly, thought he was going to lose that election and made the cabinet members sign a piece of paper that he had written, and he folded it and glued it, and they couldn't read it. He said, I want you to sign this in the cabinet meeting, and you're all committed to it. I'm not going to tell you what's in it. And what was in it was Lincoln said, I'm going to adhere to the result of an election even if I lose. I'm going to do everything I can in the transition to help win the war for the Union. But, you know, if I lose, I lose. That's a Democratic election. And they all opened it right after the election. They had a good laugh. And that was because, among other things, Sherman took Atlanta. But that's a contrast to the current person who claims to be a Republican, who seems to be headed towards nomination this year. A belief in a free and fair democratic election and accepting the result.
This out to you from President's Day from Sydney. This is the real lesson of the United States compared to what the shit we got with Trump, where he not only was going to accept it, thought he was going to lose, and wrote the resignation letters for his cabinet, but stunning that we've fallen so
far.
Well,
I'm just going to say, Sydney, Lincoln came in office not a particularly versed strategic military thinker, and he made some mistakes and he appointed some bad people, but he learned. And when he turned to Grant and Sherman, that was a commander in chief.
Yeah, it took a long time. The whole situation was completely disorganized as a euphemism in the beginning. I mean, the country was literally falling apart. There were insurrections state by state. The size of the United States Army at the time of Fort Sumter was 16,000 men. That was nothing. Winfield Scott, who was, I believe, 76 years old, was the general in chief. He'd won his plaudits as a hero of the War of 1812. He had won the Mexican War. And he was actually a very good military strategist and thinker. There was no organized army. Bull Run was a ridiculous event. There was no trained army. And they brought in McClellan, George B. McClellan, who had a West Point background. McClellan is important and was seen as a savior. It's called Little Napoleon. And the reason is about at least half of the officer corps had defected to the Confederacy. A lot of them were Southerners at the beginning of the war. I mean, there was no, they were, the word that Lincoln used for people who went to the Confederacy, who had taken an oath to the United States and were officers, was traitors. That was the word he used, including Robert E. Lee, and by name. And so you got McClellan. McClellan could train an army, but the question was, he didn't like the army to fight. he had what Lincoln said were the slows. And he was very slow. And then he waged this campaign on the Great Peninsula War, the greatest armada, military armada in world history, invaded Virginia Peninsula. And almost they got within sight of Richmond, and then he stopped. This is where Lee comes to the fore as head of the Confederate forces. But McClellan also was opposed to Lincoln's political agenda, and he was against emancipation, and Lincoln had moved towards emancipation, and Lincoln got rid of McClellan after the Battle of Antietam, where he did not follow Lee's defeated forces and end the war. But that victory allowed him to issue the Emancipation Proclamation on a note of victory. And it was then a year, you know, after Vicksburg, really, Grant had won Vicksburg, that, you know, Grant comes east, and with him comes his close friend, William Tecumseh Sherman. And then the great cavalry officer, Philip Sheridan. And we're getting a different look to the war then. And Lincoln also has gained a lot of experience about the military. Well, there's, you know, we could go on forever. Lincoln, by the way, I'll just say one thing, was somebody who had a great curiosity and knowledge of technology and science. We don't think of him that way. We think of him as a hick who comes into office. But actually, he is the only president, I believe, to hold a patent. And he spent a lot of time with the head of the Smithsonian when he was president, and created the, you know, National Academy of Science. And he spent a lot of time going over weaponry. So when the first ironclad ships were made, Lincoln sat on the board, and he would go to the board meetings, and he knew all the intricacies of this, and he made sure they were built. Lincoln personally tested each new kind of rifle. He would go to the firing range. You could hear Lincoln firing in, you know, on the lawn of the White House. So that's a different picture of Lincoln. He had a he was literally down to the nuts and bolts of the guns. He gained an understanding of the strategy, and he found Grant, which is an epic story.
Boy, it sure
in
is.
And of itself.
We could go on for hours. This is so fascinating. This may be a reach, so no, stop me if it is. I see certain parallels, as different as they were, between Lincoln and another one of my political heroes, FDR, in the sense that FDR was criticized for moving too slowly prior to World War II, and said, you know, basically you have to wait till a consensus forms. Similar to Lincoln on slavery, had a totally unfit army when we began and mobilized quickly, and was maybe the second most eloquent president we've ever had. Am I just reaching too much there, Sidney?
No, I think these comparisons are really interesting. The movie, I believe it's Abe Lincoln in Illinois, was written by the playwright Robert Sherwood. It's really about Lincoln going, you know, it shows his personal odyssey, and he's going up, he's going to go defend democracy. And Sherwood, after writing that, became the speechwriter for FDR. So there's a sense of the you know, that they're involved in the same project, that they're, you know, that they have the same crisis in it that they're facing of the fate of democracy. And just as Lincoln can't move on emancipation until he secured enough, and he evolves himself on this question as a political matter. He'd always been anti-slavery. He said, you know, I am naturally anti-slavery. I've always been anti-slavery. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. But if he moved too fast, the whole thing could fall apart. He said, if I had lost Kentucky, I would have lost Missouri and Maryland, and it would have been too much for us. Wouldn't have been able to sustain it. So for FDR, intervention in World War II, as you point out, Al, was very unpopular before Pearl Harbor. A great majority was against it. This is an isolationist majority. And you had an America First movement that Trump has copied and is drawing on. It's the same thing. And Roosevelt has to maneuver. He has to be the great politician to get Lend-Lease, to get some ships to England, fighting the Nazis alone. And it barely gets through the Congress. He knows what the stakes are. He forges the Atlantic Charter in 1940 off of Newfoundland on the ship with Churchill. He knows what's at stake. He knows what's coming, but the country doesn't. The great majority of the country doesn't. But Roosevelt has leadership, and Lincoln had leadership too. And but you can't press ahead of that. You can lead your public, but if you get too far ahead, you might lose the whole game. And both of them knew that.
James, can you think of a better dream than the three of us sitting down one night with FDR and Lincoln and just hearing them, honest to God, on politics? Oh, Sidney Blumenthal, I don't think we've ever had a guest like you. It has just been terrific. You really have elevated us. James, you want to add anything?
Yeah, I just, like, you know, the one thing that Sidney does is he understands my chosen profession. And,
understands mine, too.
People need to, right, both of ours. And people sometimes need to understand that politicians can move only so fast. And they can, and sometimes they have to build consensus to move further. And that, you know, it's a saying when you're coaching Little League, you got to let the ball come to you. You don't rush it. And sometimes in politics, you have the hand you dealt with, and you just make it a better hand by being a shrewd, smart leader and convincing people. I mean, like he pointed out, I think the real lesson here is he wanted to win the argument. All right.
He wanted to,
Roosevelt kind of knew the same thing. And that connection between the guy who wrote the book and became Roosevelt's speechwriter, I did not know that. It's a historical fact. Yeah. I think that's pretty telling. Just one more story before we let you go, because I was taught, and I think you helped teach me this. Illinois was the boondocks. That was not middle America. That wasn't the Big Ten. That was the West. And there was this kind of feeling that you know still exists today, that all the smart people came from the coast. And Lincoln went to Cooper Union. And Sidney, because I think this is important for our audience to understand, give us some context of Cooper Union, what it meant, why he went there, and what did he accomplish there?
All right, I'm going to tell you as briefly as I can the Cooper Union story.
Okay.
All right, so there's a group of people in New York. They're called, and they have a formal organization called the Young Men's Republican Club. And they are hearing people who might become Republican nominees in this new party who would not be William Seward of New York. This is a group of people that does not like Seward, who has been around for decades in New York, and they regard as corrupt, and who carries a lot of baggage with all of them. Been in politics a long time, and they want to see someone new. So they invite all these people. They've heard of this guy Lincoln because of the debates, and they've read the debates in the New York papers. Nobody has seen him. There's never been a picture of him in a newspaper. Nobody outside who hasn't seen him knows what he looks like. So they come to the hotel room. No, so the people who are going to escort him to Cooper Union knock on his door in the hotel. They put him in the Astor House, the best hotel on Broadway. Knock on the door. Guy comes to the door. He's 6'4". His hair's a mess. He's wearing a black wrinkled suit. Pants are too short. And they sort of draw in their breath. All right, we're going to do this. First, they bring him to Matthew Brady's photographic studio on Broadway, down the street. There's the photographer to the stars, the great and the good. Photography is a new medium. Just like, the telegraph was a new medium. Photography, you could actually see what people really look like. So they bring him there, and Brady cleans him up. He combs his hair. He straightens his suit. He pulls the cuff down. He puts him in front of a fake background with a pillar and a drape, and puts his hand on a book. And they take the picture. He poses for 5-10 minutes. You have to hold still. And then they take him off to Cooper Union. And the crowd, there are descriptions of people in the crowd. He delivers this great speech. He starts out slowly, seems to be mumbling, and he builds, and he gets his composure. He's introduced as the fresh new voice from the West by William Cullen Bryant, who's the great poet, who's the chairman of the committee, and also the editor of the New York Evening Post, which is a liberal newspaper then, anti-slavery newspaper, founded by Alexander Hamilton. And Lincoln then delivers a great speech about the founding fathers, their opposition to slavery, how the Constitution and why it's constitutional to be anti-slavery, and the whole current crisis, and then what those people who are in this new party must do, and why right makes might, as he says at the end. And those who had watched him in the beginning and thought they were watching some Yahoo, some hick, some, Western hayseed, by the end, one of them said, I was on my feet cheering as though, and I had heard St. Paul speak. So that's the effect that Lincoln had. And the other thing about this is, I think Lincoln knew this, and he would do this time and again. And he knew that people thought he was a hick, and he knew he had this ability, this rhetorical ability. Even though he had a high voice, it would carry, by the way. But he had confidence in his speech and his ability to move a crowd. So, and he knew that he could do it by the end. And that's what happens in Cooper Union. And I'm just going to tell one joke now about Lincoln and his ability to move around. Right.
Let the thing right, be pressed, isn't he?
All right. So Lincoln's before a jury, and he's worried they're gonna make the wrong judgment. And he's giving his closing remarks. And now I just want to preface this by saying a lot of people who were proper people thought that Lincoln was told coarse jokes. So that's the preface to this. So Lincoln says to the jury, he says, "My friends, there's a farmer, and he has a daughter, and the daughter went into the barn, and she saw her cousin up in the hayloft, and she saw a boy up in the hayloft, and she comes running back to her father, and she says, 'Father,' says, 'I saw Ellen in the hayloft, and she took her pants down. And then I saw Jesse, and he took his pants down.' I think they're taking a wee." And the father says, "Well, you have the right evidence, but you have drawn the wrong conclusion." And Lincoln turns to the jury, says, "You now have the evidence before you. Draw the right conclusion."
Oh,
that's great.
Oh, what a great story. Great. Boy, what a wonderful day for us, James, and on the President's 10-day,
sure,
the Lincoln and the Washington birthdays celebration, we aced it with Sidney Blumenthal. Sid, when does, let me find a final
Absolutely.
Question, when does Volume 4 come out?
Next year, I hope. I'm still writing, you know. I'm going to be writing today, I got to finish this year for Volume 4.
And you'll come on the podcast. God willing, we're still here.
I'm always here with you guys.
Right. Thank you so much, man. What a great
Thank
show.
Thank you for
what a great show.
Taking Thanks. The time.
Thank back. You, Sidney. And now for the outrage of the week. James, you'll recall not that long ago when J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, about growing up in hardscrabble rural Appalachia, was celebrated. Independent, conservative-leaning, outspoken, he called Donald Trump reprehensible, maybe even immoral. Then he chose to run for the Senate and decided to deep six that persona and become a Trump sycophant. He opposes any aid to Ukraine. He even claims there's a hidden provision in that measure aimed at impeaching Trump if he gets back in office. I guess he's still looking for the Elvis provision in that bill. He's no critic of Putin and speaks fondly of Hungary's autocratic Viktor Orban. Now, he now suggests Mike Pence was wrong in upholding the Constitution and presiding over the perfunctory 2020 Electoral College count. He also said his leader, the Donald, should disobey any legitimate Supreme Court decisions that are badly decided. His alma mater, Yale Law School, must be so proud. Who cares if he's weird? He tweeted something this week about sex between a dolphin and a woman. It's just that his principles are framed by jello.
Yeah, if he has principles, jello might be it, giving him more credit than the mild rage is an outrage, but a general observation. So this whole Hunter Biden thing, if you just try to unpack it, you can't imagine it. And then it was all, and of course, it's David Weiss, was of course Merrick Garland had to leave him on it because, well, we just had to do that, and then Merrick Garland, and then Weiss just cuts a deal, and it blows up in court, and there's something else, and it's all on this Smirnoff guy, who is a proven liar and Russian agent. And how do these people, what I don't understand, if we had someone as stupid as James Comer, and I mean this, literally if there was a committee chair who was that stupid, they'd kick him out. The Democrats wouldn't stand for that. This man, he and Jim Jordan are in public stupidity on a level that is unimaginable. And the thing that I find most interesting about this is they just keep their positions. And Fox just goes on like, well, nothing happened. It's just everything blows up in their face. And no one on their side really gives a shit. And you don't even tell about what's wrong with the country when you got 40% or 45% of the people in the country that want to be lied to, that when presented with staggering, breathtaking evidence, they just plow home with their ignorant, asinine views. At some level, it's humorous and depressing. I'm just going to laugh at it because if I think about it, I'll get too depressed.
I try to laugh at it, but I too get depressed, James. You're right.
Why don't Democrats do what they, because we wouldn't stand for it. If we had a president that green-lighted an insurrection, we wouldn't stand for that. It's not just that the politicians are different. They're really, Democrats and Republicans are not, of course, a caveat, not all, but most Republicans, I say this great confidently, are out of their goddamn minds.
James, you don't agree with Elise Stefanik when she said January 6th was just a peaceful protest?
And by the way, more people agree with her today than did on January the 7th. After you saw it with your own eyes. And we were so stupid, we said, well, that'll change people's opinion. And then they had the January 6th committee. They did a really good job. They believe it now more than ever did. It couldn't have any more evidence than what you see. And at least Stefanik, was put to Harvard, like J.D. Vance. If that's your intellectual leadership, that's what you got to know.
Don't leave out Tom Cotton and Ted Cruz, but no, you're right.
No,
you're
can't.
Absolutely right.
No, Ron DeSantis. Right. You know that they know better. You know that. They can't not. I mean, you couldn't be quasi-literate and not know that. It's breathtaking. I don't know if it's going to get better anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree, sadly. And now for our listener questions, always a highlight. Dave James in Seattle, Washington says, wants an update on the outlook for third-party candidates who might get votes from people who don't like Trump or Biden, and what can the Democrats do to blunt their impact?
Well, okay, there are certain things that we go into this election, and I'm very big on this, and I'm going to probably write something about it. There's certain basic measurements you look at. You look at direction of the country. That's one. It's horrible. You look at the disapprove or unfavorability of the candidates run. It's never been higher. All right? It just hasn't been. And the third party vote right now is, I don't think it's ever been higher at a comparable time. Now, it's a little complicated. It's worth taking a little time. Some are going to appear in some ballots, some are not going to appear in other ballots. And to some extent, this stuff is harder to poll than you think on first glance. But there's a real yearning for a place to park other than with the two major candidates. And that just adds to the unbelievable volatility and unpredictability of the election of 2024. I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen. But I know a lot is going to happen, and it's going to be unprecedented, and we've never seen this before. And journalism will be thinking of words to describe an event that is truly unique, and that's coming, I promise you. But which way it turns out, I'm less certain, but the fecal matter is about to engage the road.
Well, as of February, almost 95% of the surveys say that these third, fourth, fifth party candidates take more from Biden than they do from Trump. So we'll see how it plays out. Jay in Columbia, South Carolina asks, should Democratic Party members vote where possible in Republican Party primaries for Nikki Haley, where their votes could be more consequential than if they voted for Biden in Democratic primaries? First of all, Jay, there aren't very many opportunities, actually. The best opportunity was New Hampshire. It really was. And we saw that it didn't really work there. So, yeah, I would do it. If I were a registered Republican anywhere, or a Democrat, rather, and there was a primary, I'd turn around and vote for Nikki Haley. Not that I'm a big Nikki Haley fan, but I just think Donald Trump is an existential evil and danger. But I don't think it's going to be of any consequence in the pending primaries.
Agree 100%. But God sakes, people just want to do something. And if you just want to do something for the fact that you feel it's some kind of a political hygiene, please do it. And we're going to talk on this show about specific things that people can do because they really want to do something. And
we're going to get some state chairs on and do that.
Right,
that's a really good idea,
yes,
James.
We should do that. Yes.
Barbara from my birth town of Charlottesville, Virginia, ask you, James, if Trump takes over the RNC, which he's doing, and it's money, which he'll get because he's always into money, and it goes into his pockets, which it invariably does, will that mean there will be no money or less money for other Republican candidates? Will it divide their party?
Well, my friend from Albemarle County, Virginia, is very smart, and she is right on the mark on everything. You got to understand the RNC and modern Republican political history. It was always better run than the DNC. It was kind of methodical. I started dating my wife. She was chief of staff there. They got beautiful headquarters right there, Capitol Hill. I mean, it was the RNC had a I don't know, mythical, but they had a real status, and it was a real thing. And he just raped the entire thing, and then putting in, he's going to take all the money out of there. There are people, professional Republicans, I call them, that have really, not that many of them, and the public doesn't pay any attention to them, but they really hate the way that Trump is fleecing every fundraising organization in the Republican Party, and the money is not going to candidates at every level. So, I mean, in one sense, I'd rather he steal it than they spend it electing Republican legislators to gerrymander something. But the observation that our letter writer wrote was spot on.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Bobby in Allentown, Pennsylvania, says, can the Democrats tie the border bill to the upcoming continuing resolution? They're going to need Democrats to help pass it. Let's turn the tables on. I'm not sure they can do it in this vehicle. Every chance the Democrats have, they ought to talk about that border bill, because that they are in a significant disadvantage right now on the immigration issue, which is number one, two, or three in virtually every voter's minds. And this gives them, it's not an out, it's because it's real. And they ought to point out that this was a bill that was bipartisan, cobbled together largely by a very conservative senator and backed by the Border Patrol guards. And every chance they get, they ought to talk about it and put Republicans on the defensive if possible, James.
Yeah, I think this is a bigger deal than we originally thought. Because before this, you really didn't have much of an answer. All right, but asylum laws and courts and the backlogs and more, but it didn't, And now you have something concrete you can throw right in their face. And it's 100% true. All right. It was negotiated. It was all enforcement. It was, as you point out, the Border Patrol backed it. Everybody did. And then Trump said no. And who elects these people? I mean, you're sitting there, and it was all in New York 3 and everything. It's all the southern border. It's Fox. We listened to you. We came up with something, and you killed it. And the reason that Trump killed it is because they wanted chaos on the border. Right. That's what they said they wanted.
Right. And when they come back and say, it wasn't tough enough, why did the Border Patrol guards endorse it then? Why did Jim Lankford endorse it then?
But if it was tough and it wasn't tough enough, why don't you pass something else? I mean, the Civil Rights Act, I'm sorry, something was on the table that your side negotiated, the Border Patrol endorsed that would help, and you blew it up because Trump ordered more chaos. That's simple.
He ordered you.
How in the fuck you can blame
you
us for anything?
You got your instructions from headquarters, right?
Right, right.
Beth in Angola, Indiana, says, ooh, why, James, are so many former politicians, Republican politicians, George and Jeb Bush, for example, not speaking out against Trump? I realize they won't get through to the MAGA cult, but what about swing voters or independents?
You know, that's an ongoing conversation that you and I have. And first of all, they don't have any status in the Republican Party. It might help if you put something together, and it could affect some independence, and you'd have to do it with like George W. Bush and some people like that, Robert Gates, and some kind of old line, and that could help some. But in terms of the Republican Party, they don't have any place or any role in the Republican Party at all. I mean, they couldn't go to the convention; they'd be booed out of town. I mean, the takeover of the Republican Party and the Republican brand and the Republican ideology and Republican everything by Trump is just stunning. And the reason that you have J.D. Vance doing what he does, or Lisa Stefani doing what she does, or Mike Johnson doing what he does, that's because it's a Trump cult. It's not a political party.
Well, if you wanted proof of that, James, and picking up on the very good question that Beth asked, just look at the Texas Attorney General's primary 2 years ago. Jeb Bush's son, a staunch conservative with what was supposed to be a great...
Yeah, he's a nice guy. Yeah, he seemed like a totally...
Right. Ran against a indicted...
Criminal.
...crook who was the incumbent Attorney General, and he got clobbered.
Yeah. You know. I mean, it's done. That's it. It's over. And no one, look at Liz Cheney, like the most prominent Republican family in, why the hell, maybe in the entire West, all right? I mean, she was Dick Cheney's daughter at the University of Chicago, was second or third in the House leadership. Shit, she got beat by 50 points.
Going to be the next speaker or maybe the next president, one or the other, and look what happened.
Yeah, but the only way to talk about the Republican Party is in the past tense. There's just not anything. That's all gone. That's all gone. And I think the good news is, I think that Democrats are coming to that conclusion. There's nothing legit about this. This is not a party. This thing has been dead for a long time. It's a fucking cult.
Jake in Oak Arbor, Washington. I've never been to Oak Arbor, Washington. It sounds like it's on the coast.
You're probably on Puget Sound somewhere.
Probably beautiful, too. Right. Jake wants to know, when are we going to acknowledge that the mainstream media, in terms of penetration and impact, is now Fox News and the Trump propaganda ecosystem that surrounds it? Jake, I tell you what it is. It's not, it really isn't the mainstream media. It's not nearly as large as the New York Times and the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal news pages, the networks and stuff. But I tell you why it has a disproportionate amount of influence, and maybe more. They're not conflicted. They cover every story from their ideological point of view, their right-wing point of view. They don't worry about to say, hey, yeah, on the other side. Whereas the mainstream media engages sometimes, I think, wrongly in both sidisms, but even when it's good journalism, they present the context. The right wing, the Fox News, and those people, they don't care about context. They have an agenda, and they pursue it relentlessly.
So, I agree with everything you said, but I think I want to take it one step further. Their people demand to be lied to, and they will pay to be lied to. Now, I'll give you an example. Now, in the Dominion Smart case, they got the text from all of the Fox News people. They knew that Trump lost the election, but they also said, if we say that, we're going to lose our people. So it's not that they just focus on, they affirmatively lie because their people affirmatively want to be lied to. It's the marketplace at work. And that's why I keep saying there's nothing normal about this. You look at, we talked about the James Comer stuff. They don't give a shit. You think Sean Hannity gives a shit? They'll say it like, oh, I said one time, you know, or Laura Ingraham. And the whole thing is all about stealing and lying. And you can make a lot of money in the United States today by lying to people, because people will pay good money to be lied to.
They sure will. Look, our last question is from Daniel. Our last question today in San Juan Capistrano, California. That's a pretty beautiful place. And he wants to know, what are your thoughts on the California Senate race and candidates with two open seats? I don't know what he means by two open seats. Should we worry about voters splitting their ticket? I guess the other seat is up too, but there's no competition.
I think it's a runoff he probably was talking about.
Yeah, the way the California system works is the top two finishers go into a runoff, regardless of party.
Right. Steve Garvey, you assume a Republican will get in the runoff. Garvey, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about, but that's not going to hurt him at all with Republicans. He has no idea about any federal issue. The Democrats are pretty split up. And, you know, when you have a party that is powerful as the California Democrats, when you have, you know, so many congressional members, senators, governors, legislators, attorney generals, they all hate each other. And there's going to be recriminations after this primary, because they're just going to be. I would assume that it's a safe Senate seat, but Garvey's going to do it.
No, I think it's it's a safe Senate seat, and I think it's highly likely that Adam Schiff wins it, which, you know, will drive some of those House Republicans crazy. So that's worth it.
Right. I mean, who's the other one running?
Katie Porter. And Barbara Lee.
That's right, too. I mean, we're at three. And Adam, he looks like, when I see the polls, look like he's going to win. But I'm pretty sure Garvey will be in a runoff.
Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Earth Breeze and Stellar Sleep, in the episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can enjoy other shows on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.